This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moscowane. The Supreme Court's 2014-2015 term begins on Monday. We're going to spend this hour talking about the cases on the docket and those the court may still take up. With me here in the studio is Lisa McElroy. She's Associate Professor of Law at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law, and Kermit Roosevelt, Professor of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks.
So I want to start with a little bit of news. Yesterday, there was a decision related to the Affordable Care Act. A federal judge in Oklahoma ruled that the federal government could not subsidize health insurance in the states that choose to establish their own marketplaces. This could be a big blow to the ACA. Two other federal judges already have come down on different sides on this question. Lisa McElroy, is it starting to seem more likely that the Supreme Court will weigh in here on the Affordable Care Act again?
Yeah, you know, this is a really interesting issue because the text of the Affordable Care Act seems to say that it would only be state exchanges. And yet here we have an issue with federal people who are on federal exchanges. We have seen two opinions recently, one from the D.C. Circuit and one from the Fourth Circuit, actually on the very same day, about an hour or two apart. And they were different. They saw this differently. Now Oklahoma has come down on the side of where the D.C. Circuit said, which was, you know, it only says states. But the D.C. Circuit has agreed to rehear this issue. So we've got lots of different things going on around this. And if we start to see more cases at the appellate level that are disagreeing, that's when the court is likely to step in.
And so this isn't at the appellate level yet, Kim Roosevelt. So you kind of imagine that a little more activity before the Supreme Court, or do you think it could be possible that they would bring it up this term?
Well, we don't have a split of authority at the appellate level yet, and ordinarily that's what the court would wait for. Ordinarily, if you don't get that, they're quite likely not to hear the case at all. But this is Affordable Care Act litigation, and my experience is with Affordable Care Act litigation, the ordinary rules don't necessarily apply. So I would say it's somewhat more likely that the court will take this even without a split of authority. If you think about it from the perspective of the people who were on the losing side last time in the challenge to the individual mandate, there are four justices on the Supreme Court who think this law is unconstitutional, who think presumably also it's a bad thing. It should be taken out by any means necessary. This gives them another opportunity to do that. Now, Chief Justice Roberts came in. He surprised many people. He saved the Affordable Care Act last time. But this case gives those four justices who opposed it a chance to put his feet to the fire, see will he come in and save Obama again. And I wouldn't be surprised if they forced that choice on him. It only takes four votes to get the Supreme Court to hear a case. They might well say, why not take another shot?
And let's talk a little bit more about what the judge decided here. So it's just kind of help me understand the history a little bit, because we're talking about there was a change in the Affordable Care Act. The administration had to sort of make a decision, put a regulation in place, and just kind of pick it up from there, if you would, Lisa McElroy.
Right. Well, the statute, Kim, and correct me if I'm wrong, speaks only to state exchanges. And the issue is that if there's a federal exchange, am I right, does that apply? Would that apply if people have picked up insurance through a federal exchange, right? Mm-hmm. So when the state or when the court is interpreting the statute, the question is, how broadly do we interpret that? Do we look to Congress's intent? What did they really mean about purchasing insurance on an exchange? Or do we look to exactly what the statute says? And that's where the courts are in conflict, and certainly where the justices have very different philosophies about how to interpret statutes. And so this is why it's a really interesting federal issue and might go to the court.
And so, Kim, is this basically a question of whether or not the administration kind of overstepped here?
No, it's really a question of how to interpret the statute, as okay. Lisa said. So the states are allowed to set up their own insurance exchanges, and people on those exchanges will be eligible for subsidies. That's what the statute says. If the states don't do that, the federal government will come in and run the exchanges. And now the question is, if the federal government is running the exchange, can people on that exchange get subsidies also? The statute says just state exchanges. But it seems like that was probably a drafting error. So when people first noticed this, it was pointed out as a glitch in Obamacare. Now it's being presented as something more serious, because if you read the statute the way it's written, if you say no, people on federal exchanges aren't eligible for these subsidies, then they won't be required to buy insurance either because it will be too expensive for them. So they'll fall into an exception to the individual mandate. And you've got the same threat of the whole system unraveling that you had when the individual mandate was challenged before.
So if these subsidies go away, could the Affordable Care Act survive, do you think?
It would be severely compromised. And essentially what would happen is states would have the opportunity to gut it. If they didn't approve of the Affordable Care Act, they would be able to say, we're not going to set up our own exchanges, so the federal government will have to do that. But then people on those exchanges can't get the subsidies, so they won't be required to buy insurance. So effectively, the Affordable Care Act won't work in our state. It won't work for many of the people in our state. Now, it seems wildly implausible to me to think that's what Congress wanted, which is why I say I think this was a drafting error. And now the question for the court is, well, are you going to sort of overlook that and reach a sensible result, or are you going to say, hey, Congress, you made a mistake. It's not our job to fix it for you.
Right. And Congress can certainly fix it. But then we get into the political process. And will the political process support a fix here? So, you know, very often what the court will do is say, you know, Congress, we're reading what you wrote. If that's not what you meant, go back and change it. But then you have to get Congress on board, and they would have to lobby to do that.
Yeah, the administration has been pretty reluctant in going back and trying to tweak things because there's not a lot coming out of Congress these days.
That's right.
Well, so what are you going to be looking for next on the Affordable Care Act issue? What's going to be the next piece of information that will help you know whether or not the Supreme Court might take this up?
Well, they've got a petition before them from the Fourth Circuit. From that decision. So we'll know whether they grant it, deny it, or hold it. Sometime, we're not exactly sure when, we'll know what the D.C. Circuit does. So we'll know whether the D.C. Circuit reverses the panel decision, which I think is likely. So I think the D.C. Circuit is going to go with the administration on this.
And the D.C. Circuit is scheduled to hear that in December, but then it's a question of when they'll actually decide.
And then we'll also have an appeal from this Oklahoma case.
All right. So that's the Affordable Care Act. We're all going to be watching for that. That would be big news, probably whatever happens there. But I want to go into some other cases. Earlier this week, the Supreme Court delayed the start of early voting in Ohio just a day before it was supposed to go into effect. And this is similar to other cases we've seen around the country recently. We've been seeing cases like, a bunch of cases around voting. Could you help us sort of understand this Ohio case specifically? Just sort of lay the general groundwork. And Kim, do you want to do that?
Sure. So this Ohio case is about whether Ohio can restrict its early voting period. And some people are in favor of that because they believe that allowing people too much time to vote facilitates voter fraud. And some people are opposed to that because they think that certain populations, particularly poorer people and disproportionately racial minorities, have a more difficult time voting if the window is narrower. So for some people, you know, it's harder to take time off work. For some people, they don't have as flexible a schedule. So you get a disproportionate economic effect, you get a disproportionate racial effect, and you get, of course, a disproportionate partisan effect, in that it tends to disenfranchise Democrats if you restrict the voting window.
And some of these arguments may sound familiar to people here in Pennsylvania, right?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, if you think about it, we have a lot of people who would have trouble getting to the polls on a single voting day between, say, 9 and 5. And so what Ohio was trying to do was extend the period of time, maybe make it on Sundays. For example, in a lot of the African-American churches, they had this the Souls for the Polls campaign going on. After church, let's go vote, right? And so what it would do would be open it up to more voters. But some people say, no, that's a problem for exactly the reasons that Kim said, maybe voter fraud. And we've seen a lot of cases and legislation recently trying to restrict how people vote and when people vote. Some people say that it's to disenfranchise certain groups of voters.
Right. Well, and we had the big case last year about the Voting Rights Act. Maybe remind us of what that was, because that kind of plays into the larger discussion. Kim?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that there's really a common thread through all of these cases. So the Voting Rights Act question was about whether there was still a sufficiently severe problem of racially discriminatory voting restrictions to allow the federal government to exert a sort of supervisory authority over the states, and in particular to require certain states to get approval for changes in their voting procedures. And the Supreme Court said, no, the evidence that Congress relied on is out of date. We're not convinced there's still a sufficiently severe problem. And really what I think all these cases come down to is how you weigh different kinds of problems and different kinds of interests. So how hard do you think it is for people to have voter ID or to get to the polls on a particular date? How serious do you think the problem of in-person voter fraud is? And in the Voting Rights Act case, how serious do you think the problem of race discrimination in voting is? And what we've seen basically on all of these issues is the Supreme Court thinks people have no problem getting to the polls. People have no problem producing the required ID. And racial discrimination is basically a thing of the past.
And so what are we going to see next in this particular case? The Supreme Court took that action earlier this week. What happens next? do we know what happens next?
The Supreme Court, it's going to be a bit of a mess, to be honest. So the Supreme Court dissolved an injunction that would have required Ohio to keep its extended voting period. So now, with very little notice, Ohio is going to go ahead and restrict that. And probably there will be people confused about when they can vote and when they can't. And there are probably going to be people who are not going to be able to vote because they're mistaken about what the law is.
And this sort of this state of flux in the meantime, that's going to continue probably through this midterm election, right?
Yes.
That's correct, sure.
Huh. So that does sound very confusing.
And of course, there can be a ripple effect, right? Once we see it happening in Ohio, where else is this going to be happening? And how are these issues going to affect the voting population across the country?
So we have a bunch of different cases that we're going to talk about. We only have about a minute or so before the break. But this pregnancy discrimination case, and we're going to continue this discussion after the break, but I just kind of want to lay out the basics of this case. That's a really interesting case. Started with a woman who works at UPS, and Lisa, maybe you could pick it up from there.
Yeah, so this woman worked at UPS, and she was delivering packages, many of which are very, very heavy. She became pregnant, and her doctor said, I don't want you lifting anything over 20 pounds. And UPS said, too bad. Unless you've got some kind of disability or some other kind of problem that would disqualify you from doing your job, the mere fact that you're pregnant is not going to keep us from requiring you to do your job. And so she sued, saying, well, but I'm pregnant, and there's federal law that protects people who are pregnant.
All right. A very interesting case. And we're going to continue talking about that after the break. We are talking about the upcoming U.S. Supreme Court term. My guests are law professors Lisa McElroy from Drexel and Kim Roosevelt from Penn. If you have questions or comments, you can join the discussion. The telephone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. We're talking about the Supreme Court term that starts, of course, the first Monday in October. We'll be back after a break.
Doctors are committed to making sure patients stay healthy, but who takes care of the healthcare system as a whole? If you work in public health, you do, and Jefferson School of Population Health can help you to join this growing field with their Master of Public Health program. Register for an information session on October 15th at 5:30 p.m. for classes starting in January by visiting jefferson.edu/pophealthinfosession. Jefferson supports WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Wheaton Arts in Millville, New Jersey, presents the Festival of Fine Craft, Saturday and Sunday, October 4th and 5th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., both days, rain or shine. This arts festival celebrates the best of American craft. The event features traditional and contemporary work from over 130 juried artists, plus indoor and outdoor craft demonstrations, hands-on family activities, musical entertainment, specialty foods, and the popular glass pumpkin patch. Details online at wheatonarts.org.
Supporting WHYY, Solbury School, a college preparatory day and boarding school for 7th through 12th grade. Located in New Hope, Pennsylvania, Solbury School offers an average class size of 11 students and is dedicated to helping every young person discover the scholar, the athlete, the artist, and the leader within them. Solbury School's open house is Sunday, October 19th from 1 to 4 p.m. Details at 215-862-5261 or solbury.org.
This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady. We're talking about the Supreme Court's 2014-2015 term with two law professors, Lisa McElroy and Kim Roosevelt. You can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions you have about the upcoming term and the different cases that the justices may choose to hear. We're talking right now about a pregnancy discrimination case, and this involves a woman who worked for UPS lifting heavy boxes. She got pregnant. Her doctor said you shouldn't lift more than 20 pounds, but UPS said no.
That's
you have
right.
You have to keep working. And then now UPS argues that giving her light duty would give pregnant women an advantage over other employees.
Basically, yeah. So we've got a really interesting intersection between two different federal laws. There's the Pregnancy Discrimination Act that says that employers can't discriminate against women who are pregnant. And then we've got the Americans with Disabilities Act that explains when employers are required to give reasonable accommodations to employees. And what UPS said was, look, you've got to show us that there's some problem here, that you've been injured on the job or that you have a disability. And just being pregnant isn't enough for us to relieve you of your duties. And of course, what Ms. Young has said is, hey, look, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act is supposed to protect me here.
And Kim, we've seen a lot of groups signing or submitting briefs to the court, mostly I think on the side of the employee, right?
Yes. Well, you know, I think a lot of people see this as a big sex equality issue, which it really is. I mean, the question is, compare the experiences of men and women who want to work and have children. So men can do that. They don't have to get pregnant. It also turns out, statistically speaking, their wives will do more of the child care. So there's not that much of an impact on a man's career if he wants to start a family. But women must get pregnant to have children. And then, statistically speaking, they're also going to do more of the child care and housework. So, you know, we have a situation where the decision to have a family hurts a woman's career much more than it hurts a man's. And the Pregnancy Discrimination Act is designed to alleviate that burden, to try to make it less of a unique burden on women. It seems pretty clear to me that's something we would want to encourage. Seems pretty clear to me that's what Congress was trying to do.
And I think it's really interesting, given that we have three women on the Supreme Court now, particularly Justice Ginsburg, who has been such a lifelong advocate for women's rights. I think it'll be really interesting to see, for example, what Justice Ginsburg asks at the oral argument, and also whether she ends up authoring this opinion and whether Peggy Young wins.
She's been critical of the court on women's issues before. I think she said that this is a court that seems to have a blind spot when it comes to women's issues.
Yes, and she's been criticized in recent weeks because she's been making some statements, some pretty public statements, criticizing the court in that way. You know, Justice Ginsburg, I know there's a lot of controversy right now about her place on the court and whether she should retire, but she's definitely a very strong voice for women.
And some of the groups signing on supporting Young kind of surprised me. One of them, an anti-abortion organization. I'm not sure if either of you are familiar with this, but it surprised me. Their argument that and they're concerned essentially that without such accommodations that might encourage more abortion. So you get an interesting mix of people arguing.
Yeah, well, and I've also seen. Oh, sorry.
I think that makes perfect sense. You know, if you make motherhood and careers incompatible, some people are going to choose their careers, and some of those people will get pregnant anyway, and then you're actually pressuring them to have abortions.
And I've also seen the argument that if you continue to make a UPS worker lift these heavy boxes, then it could do harm to the fetus. And so certainly people who are anti-abortion might have concerns about that as well.
Hmm. So we're talking about some of the cases that the Supreme Court has already decided to take up. Another interesting one involves Facebook.
Oh, I mean,
it was only a matter of time before social media becomes a big part of what the court is looking at. But essentially a guy posted some threats threatening rap lyrics on his page that looked like they were directed at his estranged wife. Which one of you wants to pick up the case from
the... I'd love to pick this up.
Okay, you know? Go ahead, Lisa.
So, Jeff, I have two teenage daughters. And, of course, you know, they're all about social media. And I have been talking to them about this case as a cautionary tale. You have to be careful what you post. So what happened here is that we have this guy. His ex-wife gets a restraining order against him. And he doesn't like that very much. And so he starts posting things on Facebook like, you know, I'm going to detonate this thing in my pocket if you come over. And... you know, making kind of scary comments. And she said, well, you're threatening me. And he was convicted of threatening her. Now, what's interesting about this is that this is a First Amendment issue. We know that the First Amendment really was designed to protect unpopular speech, speech that we don't like very much. But one exception to the First Amendment is that you can't make a true threat. And so the issue here is, if you post something on Facebook, how do we know if that's a true threat? Do we look at it from the person who's receiving the message, the ex-wife who thinks the ex-husband's about to kill her? Or do we look at it from the intent of the guy who posted it? And he says, you have to prove that I intended it to be a threat. I was just venting. I was just blowing off steam. And so this is a really interesting issue, because if you think about it, most of us are on social media kind of in the privacy of our homes. How is a prosecutor going to prove what you intended or didn't intend?
Hmm. That seems like a really difficult, well, they all seem like difficult cases to decide. But do you see this one, a case like this, having lasting effects on anything for most of us?
Well, it's an important question whether the requirement for a conviction under this statute is an actual intent to threaten or simply doing something a reasonable person would interpret as a threat. But, you know, I think it's interesting because it's arising in the context of the internet, new technology, and that's a particularly difficult context because many of us know, I think, how difficult it is to convey tone in email, for instance. So there's a wider gap between what someone intends to convey and what other people get. And also there's the sort of disinhibiting effect of the internet where it's not a face-to-face interaction. People oftentimes will say things over email or on the internet that they would never say face-to-face.
And what the prosecutors are saying is absolutely what Kim said is right. Tone is tough on the internet, right? Because you're just reading something. On the other hand, how do you misconstrue, I'm going to detonate this thing in my pocket or I'm going to kill you if you come over to my house? Clearly, the prosecution says, yeah, a reasonable person would be afraid here.
Hmm. And so when you look at the decisions that need to be made here, and then you look at the people who are on the Supreme Court now, does it can you see where this might come out?
This particular one, I think, is a hard one to call because the conservative-liberal split doesn't work as neatly on First Amendment issues. Justice Kennedy, in particular, is a very strong First Amendment advocate.
Hmm. I think that's right. I think that another thing that we're seeing with the court that's a very, very interesting issue is how the court is having to embrace modern technology and get to understand modern technology. And very recently, even, the court asked questions in an oral argument about exactly what is a pager and what is a text message. And in the last few years, we've been seeing the court really get up to speed on what is social media? What is the internet? How do these things work? What's a text message? And there's wide speculation that their young law clerks are actually helping them understand these things. If you remember a few years ago, there was a case about violent video games being for sale. And Justice Kagan made a comment about her clerks playing Mortal Kombat. They're actually learning from the next generation and having to learn how these things work to make very modern decisions based on a very old document.
We're talking about the Supreme Court and the upcoming term. If you want to join the conversation, if you have questions for our law professors here in the studio, the telephone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also email your questions to radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So another case that the Supreme Court has decided to take up has to do with religious liberty in prison. And there's a fellow in Arkansas, an inmate, who wants to grow a beard. His name, I'm going to see if I can pronounce here, Abdul Malik Muhammad. He wants to grow a beard, but the question is whether he has the right to do that. Which one of you wants to kind of help explain this issue?
I can jump in if you want. So this is very, very interesting. With Hobby Lobby last term, you may remember this had to do with the contraceptive mandate and whether employers had to provide contraception coverage to employees if it violated their religious beliefs. And so we've seen the court really being very interested in protecting religious beliefs. Here we've got a guy who says, my religion requires me to grow a beard. And the prison system in Arkansas has said, if you grow a beard, that is a security risk. You could hide a shiv or a razor blade or something in your beard. And so the prison has said, sorry, because we have this interest in security in prisons, we aren't going to let you grow it. And he has invoked a federal statute that involves religious freedom in prisons and said, look, you got to come up with a better reason than that. My religious freedom is way more important. And in fact, one thing that may be a problem for the prisons is that Arkansas is almost singular. Most states do allow prisoners to grow beards without security consequences. So the court is going to be balancing that, religious freedom versus security in prisons, and that'll be a very interesting outcome.
So, Kim, this idea that other prisons allow it, that's important to the legal argument?
Yeah, that's very important. So technically what the prison needs to show to prevail here is that they have a compelling interest, something important that they're trying to promote, and they have that, prison security. It's a compelling interest. But they also need to show that they're using the least restrictive alternative. And this is actually where the government lost the Hobby Lobby case. They also couldn't show that they were using the least restrictive alternative. And the reason that it will be very hard for Arkansas to show that is other states seem to achieve a satisfactory level of security without banning beards. So the inmates' argument is pretty clear. You know, Arkansas has to show it's got no other way to do this, but other states are doing fine without it. So it's a tough case for the state. And I also think to some extent the Supreme Court is not likely to reject a minority religious claim right after they've received some criticism for seeming to favor majority religions. So that's not a legal consideration, but thinking realistically in terms of what sort of hanging over the justices, I would expect the inmate to win this one.
Yeah, and picking up on what Kim just said, it is very interesting because Hobby Lobby dealt with sort of a very fundamentalist evangelical view. We have six Catholic men on the Supreme Court. And so there was a lot of speculation about sort of the Christian beliefs influencing their decision making. But here we have a non-Christian person. So it'll be very interesting to see whether the court embraces all religions versus just sort of a Christian viewpoint.
And we should say that the concerns about safety with this particular inmate are real. I mean, he pled guilty to charges that he threatened to kidnap and harm the two daughters of President George W. Bush. And then a few years later, he broke into his ex-girlfriend's house and slit her throat and stabbed her in the chest. He's not a nice guy. I mean, obviously the concerns are there, but it gets back to that question of, well, there are a lot of dangerous people in the world, but other prisons are able to take care of this without overstepping the religious liberty question.
Sure, and they could put him in solitary confinement, or they could search him a lot, or there are lots of other things they can do besides make him shave.
All right, so we're coming up on an election here, and we have a case in Alabama involving race and drawing legislative district boundaries. And Kim, are you familiar with this case? You want to kind of help explain it to us here?
Sure. So the Constitution and also the Voting Rights Act place some limits on what states can do when they're drawing electoral districts. And one of the things that they can't do is use race as a predominant factor in drawing districts, unless they can show that they're trying to do something extremely important and basically have no other way to do it. And what happened here was Alabama had a certain number of majority-minority districts, which are supposed to be good things from the perspective of the Voting Rights Act. Those are districts where you have a sufficient number of minority residents that they will be able to elect the representative of their choice. But what happened when they redrew the districts was they put even more minority members into those districts. So now instead of, say, a 60% black district where the black community can presumably elect whoever they want, you've got more like an 80% black district. And now it looks like maybe those extra votes are just sort of being wasted. So if you're a sinister legislator and you're trying to minimize the voting power of the black community, one thing you could do is you could pack them into these districts so that, sure, that district is safe, but they're not competitive in any other district. And that's what people claim has been done here.
And so what is the question that the court needs to decide?
Well, the court needs to decide whether race was a predominant factor in the redistricting.
Okay.
And also whether, if it was, compliance with the Voting Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act justifies it, which is Alabama's argument.
And so then, again, looking at the decision that needs to be made and the current makeup of the court, can you see kind of where it might be headed?
Well, this is a court that has not been very receptive to claims about racial discrimination by minorities. It's been somewhat more receptive to claims about racial discrimination by white people. And in the context of voting in particular, it seems somewhat hostile to the idea that there are still racially motivated problems we should worry about. So my guess would be that they're going to uphold the Alabama redistricting.
Yeah, and particularly after the Voting Rights Act case that we talked about just a few minutes ago from last term, where the court said, you know, racial discrimination is basically a thing of the past. And, of course, the dissenters were just horrified by that concept. But we did have a majority saying, you know, we don't need to worry about this so much anymore.
The Facebook case, I think it's captured a lot of people's imagination. We did hear from Ellen, who says the regarding the Facebook threats case, the restraining order indicates that there is a threat already, so they should not ignore the issue. Does that make sense to you?
Sure. I think that that's a really important distinction to make. So the restraining order would be that there had been some kind of physical threat made against the ex-wife, right? That there was some reason why the court needed to keep them apart. But that's a very different issue from the speech issue that's at issue here, because this isn't about did he threaten her in the past. This is an issue about was what he posted on Facebook enough of a true threat to where he didn't have any First Amendment rights to say whatever he wanted.
What do you think is going to be the big case, like the headline case, once we get around to, is it June when the end of the term is?
I think same-sex marriage. I think the court's going to take that this term. I think they're going to decide it.
And what's going to – you think just the overall issue is what they're going to be taking?
Yes. Okay. I think they're going to decide, is there a federal constitutional right to same-sex marriage? And I think they're going to say yes. That's my bold prediction.
That is a bold prediction.
What do you think of that? Very bold prediction. You know, the problem that we have with that, and ordinarily I would completely agree with Kim, because we saw one step forward with that, with the DOMA case. You know, Justice Ginsburg commented recently that one problem is that there isn't any disagreement in the federal appeals courts right now. And as we discussed before, that's one major reason why the court would take a case. They would take a case because, say, the court in Texas has a different view from the court in Massachusetts. And the important goal that the court has is making sure that federal law is consistent no matter where you live in the country, that you have the same rights no matter where you live. And so if there's no disagreement right now, that's a little bit of a disincentive for the court to take the case up. Of course, there's also, you know, some kind of a question about which way is that going to go. There still is, you know, even after the DOMA case, some question about whether the justices are ready to go there.
I want to talk a little bit more about this in a minute, but we have to take another break. We have in the studio, that was Lisa McElroy of Drexel University's Law School. We also have Kim Roosevelt of Penn's Law School. They're in the studio for the entire hour. We're going to continue the discussion of the same-sex marriage and whether or not that will come up before the court after the break. If you have a question or a comment, you can join the discussion at 1-888-477-9499. Also email radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @whyyradiotimes. We'll be back after a break.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase was recognized and highlighted among Philadelphia hospitals for safety and surgical outcomes based on a nationwide study. Surgeons at Fox Chase are fellowship trained with up to 4 years of additional training on the complex techniques of cancer surgery. Part of Temple Health, Fox Chase is committed to patient safety, world-class care, and the best outcomes. Fox Chase Cancer Center, your first choice in cancer care.
The Mequon School supports WHYY. Located on a wooded campus near Northwest Philadelphia, Mequon is a progressive elementary school for children ages 3 to 12. At the Mequon School, children's curiosity and initiative are an integral part of their education. Purposeful instruction is combined with opportunities for children to explore, discover, dream, and create. An information evening is October 8th at 6:30. Info at mequon.org/evening.
Annenberg Center Live supports WHYY and presents The Events, a play about a survivor's search for answers after tragedy strikes in a place where she felt safe. Awarded Best New Play at the 2013 Edinburgh Fringe Festival and featuring a different Philadelphia community choir every night, The Events runs October 7th through the 19th at Annenberg Center Live. Tickets for The Events at 215-898-3900 or annenbergcenter.org.
This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about the upcoming Supreme Court term with Lisa McElroy of Drexel and Kim Roosevelt of Penn. You can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. We're talking about same-sex marriage and whether or not the Supreme Court will take that issue up in this term that's going to start next Monday. And Kim, you had a point to make about that.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I agree with what Lisa said about uniformity in general terms, but I think in this case, in practical terms, we've got disuniformity because in certain parts of the country there is a federal constitutional right to same-sex marriage now, and in other parts of the country there isn't. So the Supreme Court might well want to correct that. The other thing is a respect for state authority, which the Supreme Court does believe in. We've got a situation where many states have been told by federal courts, your law is unconstitutional. And generally speaking, that's a reason for the Supreme Court to grant review, because if a state is going to be told its law is unconstitutional, the Supreme Court thinks that decision should come from the Supreme Court, the highest court in the federal system, not a lower federal court.
Hmm. And it just kind of seems to me that there's a lot of people probably in the country who would like to have this question settled.
Well, I think that's true also. I think we're at the point where waiting is not going to serve anyone's interests.
And does that play into the decision of whether or not the court takes up the issue, or is it just has to be more methodical than that, of whether or not people want an answer to the question?
Do you mean does it matter if people want them to
take it up? If people in the country are kind of saying we want this decided, does that matter?
Well, you know, there are two views on that. One is that the court does what it thinks it should do, and it doesn't respond to public opinion. That's why all these protests outside the Supreme Court, the justices say, you know, they don't pay any attention. They don't know what's going on out there. On the other hand, we do know that the court doesn't typically sway too far from sort of consensus public opinion or majority public opinion. They tend to be pretty consistent with where society is. So that's a really tough question.
Hmm. Any cases that we haven't talked about yet that you think the court might still take up?
Well, we've got some abortion stuff that's in the pipeline. Certainly, we've seen in many states that there are restrictions that are becoming more and more onerous. For example, the requirement that abortion clinics meet the standards of outpatient surgical centers and so forth. And so these things are percolating in the lower court, and it's possible that an abortion case could make its way to the Supreme Court this term. If not this term, almost certainly next term.
What about the Hobby Lobby case? Is that one already nice and clear and done and decided, or is there anything there that might need a little clarification?
Well, I think what we're going to see with Hobby Lobby is how it applies to other things.
Okay.
You know, certainly employers, you know, who object to contraception, but are there other types of religious beliefs, religious practices that we're not going to require people to do? And so that's a really interesting sort of extension of the law. Where do we go from here after we've had this decision on contraception?
I want to talk a little bit about what it's like inside the court, because I think for most of us, about the only image we have of the Supreme Court is a bunch of justices before a red curtain, you know, in their robes. And Kim, you've worked in the Supreme Court. You clerked for Justice Souter during the 1999-2000 term. What is it like just sort of day-to-day working in the court?
Well, the Supreme Court sort of pops into the national consciousness every June when it hands down these big decisions. But it is worth understanding that it's working the rest of the time. During the summer, the justices are away, but the clerks are actually there. So as a clerk, most of your time there is not that exciting. You know, there's a big buildup to the end of the term, but most of the time there, it's a more routine work day. You know, you come in. The Supreme Court is actually a very nice, sort of collegial, almost familial place. The marshals know all the clerks by name, so they'll greet you by name on your way in. And a lot of the time, the clerks are just sort of writing memos, sometimes about how they think cases should be decided to advise the justices, but more frequently about what should be done with petitions, what they think the court should do with the question of what cases it should hear.
Yeah, it is sort of, for most of us, it's that when the opinions are released, but there's more of a, it's a lot of work.
It is a lot of work.
It's a lot of writing and a lot of research. And
huge amount of research, yeah, and of course, a lot of pressure, because it can be very embarrassing if a clerk makes a mistake. So you get this sort of short burst of intense drama in the national consciousness, but there's months and months of very hard work that goes into that.
And how do they keep the opinions secret up until the day? Because there's got to be dozens of people who know about them before they come out.
Well, the clerks take their obligations very seriously. So it's almost unheard of to have a leak from inside the Supreme Court.
And that said, a couple of years ago with the ACA, we did have a very big leak after the fact, where it was widely discussed what happened there. And it was interesting because this hit the media. And my first response is, that can't possibly be right. There can't possibly be a leak, because the people who work in the building do take their oath and their obligations so, so seriously. So when there is a leak, it's headline news.
Let's go to the telephone. We have Steve from Chestnut Hill. And Steve, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
Wasn't there, going back to the gay marriage, wasn't there a federal judge in Louisiana that did upheld the ban on gay marriage there?
Yes, there was. That's a lower court decision, so we don't know if we'll end up with a circuit split. If that decision gets sustained on appeal, then certainly the odds will go up of Supreme Court review.
All right, and thank you for your call. I want to talk with you, Lisa, for a few minutes about secrecy, because
yeah,
part of that mystery for us is that we don't get to see all of that hard work that goes into putting a decision together. And you recently co-authored an article on Salon about parts of the court. You know, parts of the court processes are very secret, parts of it are very public. To just kind of lay out what you were trying to convey in that article.
Yeah, well, you know, you talked a minute ago about seeing the justices in their robes, you know, almost like penguins, right? Where we get this vision of them as a group, and that's all we ever see. And the court is very, very deliberate about that. They say that it's because it protects the legitimacy of the institution for us not to see how they're making sausage behind the scenes. But there could be a really interesting legitimacy effect were the court to be more transparent. For example, were they allowed cameras at the Supreme Court, which many, many people, the majority of people now say, they would love it if there were cameras at the Supreme Court. Think how that would preserve the legacy for students and lawyers and history students going down the line. The court is also very not transparent about a lot of other very important things. For example, if someone recuses themselves, if a justice says, I'm not going to participate in deciding this case, well, why did they do that? And if they refuse to recuse themselves, they don't have to explain that either. And so it can really make the public a little bit suspicious. Like, you know, for example, why did Justice Kagan participate in the Affordable Care Act case when she had been Solicitor General? If she had explained herself, maybe that would have contributed more legitimacy to the court. So we've got this marble palace on a hill, which is very, very cloistered. And the American public doesn't know very much, except in June. And I think also the public thinks that the court is always very, very split along ideological lines, which in fact is not the case. Last term, out of 70 to 80 cases, the court only split 5-4 in 10 cases. The court is usually unanimous, as a matter of fact. So these are all things that the public doesn't really know about the court. And I think the more the people knew about the court, the more trust they might have in the institution.
What do you think of this idea, Kim, of having cameras? If you could sort of watch the Supreme Court justices deliberating and watch them listen to some of the best legal minds in the country, would that enhance the reputation?
I don't know if it would enhance the reputation. I think it would enhance understanding. I do support the idea of televising the arguments. Justices have expressed concern that lawyers would grandstand and play to the TV instead of addressing the court. I can see that concern, but I think that giving the public a greater understanding of what actually goes on is worth it.
Yeah, and I actually interviewed some of the top Supreme Court advocates, the people who have argued before the court over and over and over again, and said, what do you think? Do you think there would be grandstanding? And I wrote about this in an article. And they said, you know, I am so focused on those justices and so focused on making the very best argument that I can that I would just – a camera would make absolutely no difference. I wouldn't even be aware because this is what I'm doing. I am trying to – really make a fabulous case before the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I think that's what a lot of – something that I've learned as a journalist that I don't think I understood before is sort of how intensely legal minds think. It's a different level of concentration and thinking than most of us experience in the rest of our life.
And that's what makes it so much fun to do what Kim and I do and to follow the court, because thinking about how these justices think and how they get to the decisions that they make and why they do, how judicial decision making takes place and what that dynamic is among nine individual people, it's a really fascinating thing to think about.
And Kim, do you think that there is general distrust because people don't see what's going on, or do you think – what do you sort of get a sense of the feel out there in the country about the, about courts generally, even?
I don't think that there's a distrust of the Supreme Court because we don't get to watch the arguments. I think there's a little bit of distrust because we don't get explanations for recusals or decisions not to recuse. I think primarily people's opinion of the Supreme Court is affected by what it decides. And, you know, if you look at the Supreme Court in the broad sweep of history, it hasn't been a great institution necessarily. It was pretty aggressively pro-slavery before the Civil War. It resisted the New Deal. It resisted various kinds of workplace reforms during the Progressive Era. If we're talking about the Supreme Court and its legitimacy in general, I think what we're seeing is sort of the end of the Warren Court honeymoon. So there was a time, the Warren Court, the Civil Rights Era, when it looked as though the Supreme Court embodied what was best about America and as though it could actually lead us to our better selves. But I think what we're seeing now is more of a return to the normal pattern, which is the Supreme Court as sort of a break on progress.
And there certainly is no question that the public perceives the Supreme Court as highly ideological, that the justices have made up their minds before they even hear a case based on politics rather than on the merits of a case. And I think that Kim would probably agree that that is somewhat of a misperception, that the justices take the law very, very seriously. And it's important for the public to understand that.
Well, and I think I can understand that when you think about some of the justices, but I hear people say that about Justice Roberts, and he keeps surprising people.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the thing about Justice Roberts is, in contrast to the public view, which is false, right, that the justices are purely politically motivated, Justice Roberts in his confirmation hearing suggested that a good judge does nothing but mechanically apply the law, that they're just an umpire calling balls and strikes. And that's just as false, I would say, as the view that judging is inherently political. What it really comes down to, in my view, is the fact that many of these difficult constitutional cases don't really have clear answers. They require you to balance competing interests. That requires you to decide how important those interests are, how serious certain problems are, how valuable certain goals are. And what people think about that is inevitably affected by their worldview, which has something to do with political ideology. That's how political ideology comes into constitutional decision making. It's certainly not the case that judges think one result is legally right, but I dislike it politically, I'm going to vote the other way. But the way that they see the world, their general worldview, affects their decision-making.
I guess if being a judge was all about calling balls and strikes, we wouldn't have had something like the Warren Court.
That's right. And I also think, though, that the justices take very seriously their role in interpreting and applying the law. So you mentioned Chief Justice Roberts earlier about how there was this surprise vote in the Affordable Care Act case. You know, he looked very closely at the taxing power, and he said, I think this applies. And he looked very closely at the idea that we uphold statutes if we can. And that certainly played a part in how he ruled. You know, I wrote a book with the cooperation of Chief Justice Roberts about him. And, you know, he told me that he thinks the rule of law is the most precious, miraculous thing there could ever be, and that the legitimacy of the institution is a huge responsibility for him. So they're working very, very hard there to gain the public's trust. I just think that with more transparency, they'd have a better shot at doing that.
So I want to wrap up by sort of providing our listeners your assessment of the Roberts Court so far, and sort of just a general something that you know and have sort of concluded that our listeners might not know. Let's start with you, Kim.
Well, my general take on the Roberts Court is actually pretty negative. I mean, like I said, I don't think that there's a pure political motivation at work. I think that what happens is that the way justices decide cases, what they honestly believe the right answers are affected by their worldview. But what I see on the Roberts Court is a court that, generally speaking, has sympathy for the powerful. The Warren Court had sympathy for the powerless. The Warren Court was interested in looking out for the interests of the losers in the political process. And the Roberts Court seems to be taking care of the winners.
And Lisa, your assessment of the Roberts Court at this point?
You know, we're 10 years in. It's the 10th anniversary of the Roberts Court. And I think that what we're seeing is that there's more vigorous dissent, that the majority is, when there are 5-4 splits, is fairly consistent. Justice Kennedy has been in the majority in every single 5-4 opinion in the last term. And so what we're seeing is some really vigorous dissent and people really disagreeing with each other in a very public way.
All right. Well, that is Lisa McElroy. She is an associate professor of law at Drexel University. And we've been talking about the Supreme Court this hour. And that that new term is going to start on Monday. It's going to be interesting to see what happens. Lisa McElroy is a professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. And Kermit Roosevelt is a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. He's also author of The Myth of Judicial Activism and the novel In the Shadow of the Law. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks,
Jeff.
You.
I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moscoane.